Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Basha Cummings and I'm the host of a weekly investigative show called The Slow Newscast from Tortoise. As our name suggests, we are a newsroom with a different approach to journalism. We take the news slowly and each week the team brings you one investigation that really matters and helps you make sense of the world. From the inside stories of politics to true crime and injustice to real life mysteries. Subscribe to The Slow Newscast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
From global current affairs to art, science and culture, the documentary from the BBC World Service tells the world's stories. Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on the 19th of April, these are our main stories. In Sudan, those are explosions in Khartoum. Many people are trying to get out after days of fighting and bombardments.
They're just bombed. The house was shaking, the windows and the doors. It's very frightening today, even more than the past 4 days.
Russian ships lurking in European waters. Are they really part of a plan to cut crucial power and communication cables? And in Poland,
today, we bow our heads low to all those who fought against the hatred of Nazism for their freedom and dignity.
Commemorations on the 80th anniversary of the Warsaw Jewish Ghetto Uprising. We start in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, where black smoke has been billowing up into the bright blue sky. The sounds of heavy gunfire there and explosions were the wake-up call for people there yet again as fighting between the army and a paramilitary group has continued. More than 200 people have been killed in about 4 or 5 days of fighting and many more injured. A large number of residents have now started fleeing the capital. Jua Tariq is a resident there.
Nobody's safe currently in Khartoum, and today is even heavier in my area, East Khartoum, and they're just bombed like 5 minutes away from my house. The house was shaking, the windows and the doors. It's very frightening today, even more than the past 4 days. And the ceasefire of yesterday did not work. It wasn't real. It was even a heavier fight, and today the sky is completely grey.
Well, for Jan Egeland from the Norwegian Refugee Council, peace can't come soon enough.
You cannot operate when there is fighting all over the place, when it's unsafe to drive on the roads, when the airport is closed, etc. 4 humanitarian colleagues, at least, have been killed. Many of our facilities have been looted. I'm talking about humanitarian organizations who have seen their warehouses looted, their compounds invaded, their staff held at gunpoint. Colleagues have been sexually abused. It's really very bad.
The BBC's Mercy Juma is in the region and told us why a peace process that was to be started by regional leaders has now stalled.
3 African presidents, including Kenya's President William Ruto, South Sudan's Salva Kiir and Djibouti's president, were supposed to go to Sudan to broker a peace deal, but that has not happened. And the information you get from the Kenyan president is that he doesn't think that he will be going today. And like you have heard from people who are in Khartoum, the situation does not allow anybody to go in. Words that were also echoed by Al-Bukhran, the army chief, saying that the situation in the country does not allow any of the presidents to go in. There have been reports of fighting not only in Khartoum, but also in Darfur, where, there's massive looting ongoing. MSF has just put out on their social media a while ago that their compound was raided by armed men who stole everything, including vehicles and office equipment. And there is a huge, huge concern that this is now turning into a humanitarian disaster.
Military jets firing onto the ground at paramilitary trucks driving around Khartoum. It's little wonder that civilians are being caught up in this and they're terrified to go out. And it's having a big impact on hospitals as well, I hear.
It is having a massive impact on hospitals. The doctors' council, the doctors' union in Sudan says out of 59 hospitals, 13 cannot operate because either they have been shelled or, you know, they have been looted or they have had to evacuate everyone. And there are thousands of people who are injured. And the truce was supposed to, you know, to necessitate, you know, the passage of those who are injured to go and access medical help. And even, you know, give civilians a chance to just go out and get, you know, the basic amenities. It's 4 or 5 days to end of Ramadan. Eid is coming. They're supposed to be happy, celebrating, looking out for their loved ones. But now they are just indoors. And it's a really sad place to be, as if you check just the tweets coming from people who are in Khartoum and Darfur and other regions that are experiencing what's happening.
That was Mercy Juma, the family of a black teenager from Missouri who was shot in the head after ringing the wrong doorbell. Says that he's expected to recover, but has a long road ahead. Their lawyer also told the BBC that 16-year-old Ralph Yar was surprised by how much attention his case had received. The shooting last Thursday sparked outrage, protests, and then, days later, the arrest of Andrew Lester, an 84-year-old white homeowner. Mr. Lester, who turned himself in on Tuesday, faces charges of first-degree assault and armed criminal action. Our North America correspondent Nomia Iqbal sent this report from Kansas City in Missouri.
Hundreds of people turned out at a rally in support of Ralph Yar.
There is no denying the racial component of this shooting.
They believe what happened to him was a hate crime and want a federal investigation.
It's just heartbreaking to know that 5 minutes away, it could have been my brother, it could have been my cousins, it could have been my little nieces or nephews.
If it wasn't for the protest, I don't think that charges probably would have even come about. There should not have been any hesitation at all.
What do we do? Stand up my back! What do we do? Stand
this incident occurred last week. Ralph had gone to pick up his twin brothers from a friend's place, but accidentally went to the wrong house and rang the bell. He was shot twice. Here's his mother, Cleo.
It was about 9:45. I'm like, Ralph, can you please pick up your brothers for me? Being the kiddies he is, he said, okay. And while he was standing there, his brothers didn't run outside, but he got a couple of bullets in his body instead of a couple of twins coming up out and giving him a hug.
And all we hear is a bunch of banging at our door.
Whilst bleeding, Ralph tried to get help from other neighbors. Zach lives on the street where the shooting happened.
There was blood from the where he was at, all the way up, all over the door. You hear about these things on the news over time, and then when it really happens to you, it's a life changer.
The teenager was taken to hospital, but is now at home recovering. The man accused of attacking him, 84-year-old Andrew Lester, was questioned that night, but released hours later. That sparked protests and eventually led to two charges and a warrant for his arrest. Here's the local prosecutor, Zachary Thompson.
We understand how frustrating this has been, but I can assure you that the criminal justice system is working and will continue to work.
In front of me is Andrew Lester's home. It's a single-story, simple building. There are egg stains, however, on the door and there's graffiti on the outside, including the number 16, Ralph Yarl's age. Now, Andrew Lester, an old man, said he was simply acting in self-defence. And there are controversial laws in this state, known as Stand Your Ground, which allow citizens to take action if they feel their life is at risk. Mr. Lester said it was late at night, he thought it was a break-in, and that he was scared of Ralph Yarl's tall height. But Ralph's family believe it wasn't his height that made Mr. Lester reach for his gun.
This was a hate crime because the shooter was motivated by the race of the victim.
That's family lawyer Lee Merritt.
How's Ralph doing?
Ralph is doing amazingly well considering. I'm so blown away by his physical recovery that we can get lost in the fact that he still has a long way to go to recovery. His skull is cracked open. He just scraped bullet fragments off his head. He has problems with memory. He has problems controlling his emotions. He has problems with his speech. But he's alive and he's recovering every day.
This was about pressing the wrong doorbell. And in New York State, something similar has happened. A 20-year-old woman pulled into the wrong driveway. Kaylin Gillis was shot dead by the homeowner, who has now been charged with second-degree murder. Every day, innocent mistakes,
but met by gunfire in America.
Nomia Iqbal reporting. It's been described as one of the deadliest blazes in the Chinese capital in recent years. At least 29 people have died after a fire broke out at a hospital in Beijing on Tuesday. Videos shared on social media show people escaping out of windows using tied bedsheets as makeshift ropes. Our Asia Pacific editor, Michael Bristow, gave us more details.
It began on Tuesday about lunchtime. It was quite quickly put out, actually. About half an hour it took the fire service to extinguish all the flames. But in that time, as you said, 29 people died. There were several more who were injured, some critically, so that death toll might increase somewhat. And as you mentioned there as well, really dramatic footage of people escaping, not just going down bedsheets tied together, but shimmying down drain pipes. There's images also of medical staff and patients standing on air conditioning units placed on the walls outside of windows in order to escape the smoke. So really dramatic scenes. And there's a lot of anger in China at the moment in Beijing, because news of this fire, even though it's happening in a really built-up urban area, news of the fire by officials and on the media took several hours to come out. And several family members complained that, you know, they just didn't know that their relatives who were in hospital had been caught up in this blaze.
And what are the authorities doing in terms of rounding up people who may have owned the building, that kind of thing?
The authorities already arrested 12 people, including the head of the hospital and the head of a construction company who were working inside the building. This fire started in a part of the hospital which was being renovated. This is a feature of accidents like this in China, that very quickly the authorities moved to arrest people. There can't have been much investigation because we're so a shorter time after the fire, but there's a lot of demand from the public to find people who are responsible for this. And so a lot of these arrests are really a reaction to that more public relations exercise by the government in order to sort of arrest people, to show people that they're doing everything they can to find the people responsible.
So the authorities are often quick to react in these kind of situations, but what about the underlying regulations in place? I suppose they vary from part to part of the country, don't they?
Well, they're looking at those regulations at the moment. That's one of the announcements. Interesting also with this issue, comments about the fire have been censored on the media, because this is another feature about big accidents in China, that the authorities look to censor the news online, censor what people are saying, because they don't want bad news to get out there. And so a lot of comments are being taken down from online posts and online websites. Another feature of the authorities, how they react to big incidents like this in China.
Michael Bristow. That is the sound of sirens to mark the 80th anniversary of the start of the Warsaw Uprising. The presidents of Poland, Germany and Israel were all in attendance at the ceremony on the site of the former ghetto where 80 years ago today, Jewish people fought desperately and heroically to save themselves from forced deportation to concentration camps. It is the first time a German head of state has been asked to speak at the commemoration. And addressing the crowds, the German president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, asked for forgiveness for his country's crimes in the Second World War. Speaking at the ceremony also, the Polish president, Andrzej Duda, praised the heroism of those involved in the uprising.
Pochylamy dzisiaj nisko głowę przed bohaterami powstania w getcie.
Today we bow our heads low to the heroes of the ghetto uprising, to all those who fought against the hatred of Nazism for their freedom and dignity. Polish Jews, Polish citizens who never gave up, never lost their spirit, and who to this day are an example for all of us.
Our correspondent Adam Easton was in Warsaw at the ceremony.
If you can hear in the background, the military having a roll call of honour to people who died in the uprising, and also to people who helped to save Jews during the war. The tone, as you said, very much from the German president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, was one of humility. He said it was difficult to address people here in the site of the former Warsaw ghetto. It's so difficult, but so necessary, he said, to come here as a German. The terrible crimes committed here fill me with profound shame. This is an 80th anniversary of an event which commemorates one of the most remarkable acts of defiance in the whole of the Second World War. Just several hundred, maybe 500 young men and women in April 1943 knew what their fate was. They knew that 300,000 people had been transported to Treblinka, to the death camps, and they chose to stand up and fight. They chose to decide how they wanted to die. They knew they probably wouldn't survive, but they made that decision anyway because they didn't want to be taken like lambs to the slaughter. They wanted to have the freedom to make their own choice.
That was Adam Easton. Coming up,
so this is basically a song about strong people who are staying in a good attitude in the negative situation.
We'll hear from Ukraine's Eurovision hopefuls.
Hello, I'm Basha Cummings, and I'm the host of a weekly investigative show called The Slow Newscast from Tortoise. As our name suggests, we are a newsroom with a different approach to journalism. We take the news slowly, and each week the team brings you one investigation that really matters and helps you make sense of the world. From the inside stories of politics to true crime and injustice to real-life mysteries. Subscribe to The Slow Newscast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
Exploring the events shaping our lives through original documentary storytelling.
We'll hear arguments for Roe against Wade.
The documentary from the BBC World Service is a window onto the wider world.
The security situation in Europe has changed in the last couple of years dramatically.
Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now, what can be more innocent than a fishing boat doing its work around the coastlines of Scandinavia? The North Sea is well known for its stocks of cod and mackerel. Well, it turns out that some of the Russian ships that are supposed to be trawling for fish may actually be searching for something more sinister. The Norwegian Intelligence Service says they're looking for vulnerable communication and power lines that Russia could cut in the event of a war. I asked our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss, where these allegations came from.
These come from a documentary which has just been released. It's a huge investigation they've done, involved the television stations of Sweden, Norway, Finland and Denmark. And yes, what they say is there are these Russian ships going up and down the coast, pretending to be fishing, some of them supposedly scientific research vessels. What they're actually looking for is spots they could sabotage. I think, you know, people may not realise the vast amount of power and communications that go under the sea. If you send an email or a text, it may go bouncing up to a satellite before coming back to Earth. It may go through a cable under the sea. And think also about power, you know, with all those offshore wind farms, the energy's got to come to land. Also, countries send power from one to the other according to availability. So clearly there would be problems if these cables, these power lines, fuel lines were cut. And we know this because there have been accidents in the past that have caused havoc. Russia apparently is aware of this potential and is looking for these spots to hack through. In fact, they may have done so already. Last year, a communication cable was cut near the Norwegian island of Svalbard. That's right up in the Arctic. At the time, police said this was caused by human activity. They just didn't know who. The new revelation suggests it may have been Russia. There are two reasons why these Russian ships are now suspect. One of them was the routes they were taking. They just did not look like the kind of routes fishing boats would take. There was another giveaway. Ships have these transmitters they're supposed to have on to identify who they are and where they are. And these ships have been intermittently switching them off. Now, obviously, if you want to sabotage, you have got Navy ships. Russia has plenty of Navy ships to do this. But the head of the Norwegian Intelligence Service, Nils Andreas Stensen, says you don't need a naval ship to carry out dodgy activities.
Spy ships are many things. But first and foremost, they're vessels built to collect intelligence.
either to collect electronic or acoustic information undersea. However, civilian vessels can also be used to collect information. They can be perfectly normal, but carry intelligence agents, or they can be fitted out with intelligence equipment. Some of them have unusual antennas, and then there are their unusual behaviour and movement patterns.
So, Paul, I suppose we shouldn't be necessarily surprised by all this, should we?
No, not really. I mean, I think maybe the obviousness of it might be a surprise, but the fact is there are increasing tensions between NATO countries and the West. Sweden and Finland, the two Nordic countries, Finland's already joined NATO, Sweden hoping to soon. And the fact is countries do choose targets in advance when there's a chance of a conflict. I have absolutely no doubt that NATO countries have chosen targets in Russia, that South Korea and North Korea have chosen targets. I suppose what's interesting is just that the importance attached in this modern world to communications, to power lines, the fact that so much effort being put into this kind of targeting, that tells us something about modern warfare.
Paul Moss. Police across Latin America have seized cocaine and other drugs worth $5 billion in an operation lasting 3 weeks and spanning 15 countries. They also seized more than 8,000 illicit firearms and carried out almost 15,000 arrests. Forces from Mexico in the north to Argentina in the south exchanged information in the operation, which was coordinated by Interpol. My colleague Reedy Thlaby spoke to Joan Grillo, a journalist in Mexico. She asked him just how successful was this mission.
When you look at Latin America and the amount of illegal guns there are here, you know, we're talking about a continent with more than a million murders, mostly from firearms in a decade. Just in Mexico itself, more than 200,000 firearms every year being trafficked here from the United States, then really this is not even that many. There's only really a small amount of that to go after. And the level of organized crime, I mean, you know, they mentioned in this operation they went after in Brazil, a thing called the First Commander of the Capital, a very, very powerful group, the Mara Salvatrucha in Central America. But again, there's very, very powerful organized crime groups across the continent. So this is really only scratching the surface of their operations. There was drugs taken from right across. You know, one of the major routes is going to the United States. Another major route is going to Europe. So you have big amounts of cocaine which go over the Atlantic Ocean, go to Spain, some of them bouncing through Africa. It's also a place for taking cocaine. But also there's actually now a very large market for drugs in Latin America itself. It's changed from a place which only produces and traffics drugs to a place with a big base of users, particularly in Brazil. Brazil, in fact, has now more people taking crack cocaine than the United States. And Mexico's got a growing problem with crystal meth and even with fentanyl, which is a really venomous drug.
Another question is how these cartels are just able to coordinate their operations across borders, you know, so successfully. Mexico, alongside other South and Central American countries, are tackling their war on drugs. How successful are the measures in place to tackle this growing problem? What needs to be done?
Well, the problem with the war on drugs, which has been, you know, waged for 50 years now since Richard Nixon first, you know, called it public enemy number one, you know, is you have this huge demand and you're fighting a marketplace. When you say, you know, why are they so organized, I think it's really the incentive of money. When you have people, you know, the drug market, according to the United Nations, is globally worth $320 billion. In the United States, it's worth almost half of that. So you have people wanting to pay all this money for the cocaine, the crystal meth, the fentanyl, the marijuana, and they're paying for it so people will move and work together and move these things. Now, it really has not been overall very successful. The drugs are still moving. There's been, you know, the military is deployed in Mexico in a very big way. There's a military deployed in Colombia and in various countries, but there's still now, you know, huge amounts of drugs being produced, and that's why some, you know, presidents in this continent, like the president of Colombia, have said, well, this is really not working. We have to rethink the whole thing and maybe even, you know, start to legalize more drugs because we cannot defeat, you know, in this way, the drug trade.
Reedy Thlaby was speaking to Joan Grillo. The streaming giant Netflix is shutting down its DVD rental service. Didn't know people still use DVDs, but they do. Well, the service helped launch the platform. Many years ago. Our business reporter Katie Silver has more.
They've been doing it for 25 years. It launched back in 1998. And the company says that it was the booster rocket that got streaming to a leading position. But now the company's been struggling to reignite growth. Last year, for example, we saw them have two quarters of subscriber numbers dropping. It was the first time in a decade we'd seen something like that. And now the latest results do show a gain in subscribers' numbers. They were up about 1.75 million for the first 3 months of this year. But it is much less than investors were forecasting. And one forecast, for example, for the week, the months ahead was lower than many had expected. One analyst, for example, told the BBC that the quarter's results raises more questions than answers. So now with these streaming giants, you know, they started as had early dominant advantage. Now with big competition from the likes of Paramount and Disney Plus, they're having to reinvent themselves somewhat. So partly that's out with the old, so ending the DVD rental service, but also coming up with some new ideas. So, for example, the firm has been cracking down recently on password sharing in some countries, such as Canada. They say, for example, there's about 100 million households sharing passwords in breach of the company's official rules. And, of course, that's going to hit their revenue. And so far, these trials in some countries have worked. And they say that it's helped, for example, paid membership to grow, and they're going to be launching that in more places. And they've also introduced ads in some markets, which means that they can offer a cheaper streaming option because it's subsidised by ads.
That was Kelly Silver. Ukraine's Eurovision entry this year say they always have war at the back of their minds when they perform. The country won last year and the pop duo Tvorchi are hoping to defend the title, even though the event is being hosted in Liverpool in England because of Russia's continuing invasion. Our Ukraine correspondent James Waterhouse has been to meet them.
So there aren't many reasons for being in a nightclub during the afternoon.
One, two, one, two.
But a sound check is probably one of them. I'm backstage at this darkly lit venue in Lviv, watching Tvorchi. They're made up of Andriy Hutsiliak and Jeffrey Kenny. They're Ukraine's electronic Eurovision entry, and this is the song they're hoping to win it with, Heart of Steel. Don't get what you say, yeah, yeah.
We can describe it in three words: strength, confidence, and positivity. So this is basically a song about strong people who are staying in a good attitude in the negative situation.
Do you think you can win? That's the kind of...
For us, it's important to win, so our country win this war against the occupants who came on our land. And about the Eurovision... If you're going to win Eurovision, we will appreciate that too, you know. Don't be scared to say just what you are
watching. Liverpool. A crowd of 600 cram into the club before the nightly curfew kicks in. And you soon realise this is a rare sight in Ukraine today.
There's a real sort of uplifting atmosphere here, and people are, frankly, letting off some steam.
We mingled with some of Tvorchi's fans, where there was an appetite for Ukraine to be conveyed at Eurovision as more than just a country under attack.
I think that the previous year it was about a war, and now we have to show people that Ukraine is just a culture, it's about our language and about Ukraine.
We should speak, we should sing, we should dance, and we should... don't forget about culture, of course. So it's very important for us to, even now.
Tvorchi have brought us to Ternopil, a city in western Ukraine where the pair met in a chance encounter in 2016. Jeffrey came here from Nigeria to study pharmacy, and Andriy stopped him in the street to practice his English.
And the next day went out for beer and... It literally started on this street, so...
You know what's funny?
Jeffy and Andriy attract regular stares and even get asked for a selfie. They're clearly more recognisable than in their student days.
And do you both understand that there will be, of course, people who don't have room for Eurovision at the moment? It's not even on their horizon.
Yeah, we understand. We're not really pulling in everyone, you know, who doesn't want to watch it. Back in Nigeria, for example... They don't watch it, none of them. So even my parents, I had to tell them before they even knew about it. So I think even now they still don't watch it. They just know I'm going for something.
During the outbreak of Russia's full-scale invasion last year, Jeffrey decided to stay in Ukraine. Mainly, he says, because of his music with Andriy. Now it is the pair's music which is making them leave the country for Liverpool.
James Waterhouse reporting there. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Alicia Thursting and the producer was Phoebe Hobson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.